whispered, it seems your eyes are troubled, care to share your time with me? Would you say you're feeling low and so a good idea would be to get it off your mind? See, you and me have a better time than most can dream of it, better than the best. So get the put on through while Galatea is a test. Whatever holds us down, and if nothing can be done, we'll make the best of what's around.
And welcome to the 19th Hole Golf Show. I'm Ryan Ballingy. Good to have you here with us. You can get a hold of me on Twitter, at Ryan Ballingy. You can get a hold of Golf News Net on your favorite social media service at Golf News Net. And you can check out our website, golfnewsnet.com, as well our apps for GNN Radio for your Apple and iOS devices. You can also find us on your TV on Roku. Download the Golf News Net app. We are presented by BetDSI.com. They've been paying winners for 20 years. They're an A-plus rated sports book on multiple review sites. And you can use your sports knowledge to make some extra cash. BetDSI has odds on everything golf, including special matchups and props, live in action. And they've got odds on pretty much everything else from sports to politics to reality TV. Use the promo code GOLFNEWS25 to get a free $25 wager just for registering. And if you choose to deposit, you'll get a 200% bonus match on your money. Again, go to BetDSI.com and use the promo code GOLFNEWS25 for a free $25 wager and a 200% bonus on your deposit. All right. On this week's show, our guest is world number one long driver Maurice Allen. He has been traveling the globe, kicking ass in Europe, kicking ass in the United States, became number one with the Mile High Showdown event on Golf Channel in the world long drive ranking. And so we had a conversation with him earlier this afternoon that we recorded. And unfortunately, he's out of worlds, got knocked out before the television rounds, and gave some interesting insight on why the World Long Drive Championship in particular is unique and difficult for him in terms of managing his energy levels, managing getting through the championship. He gave some interesting insight on that as well. His journey to being number one in the sport, what it means to have this additional exposure through the televised events Golf Channel is doing, and where he sees the sport going in the future. So, interesting conversation. Hopefully, you will enjoy that. Wanted to talk a little bit about the FedEx Cup playoffs. Obviously, we've had two very good events. Once again, the FedEx Cup playoffs deliver. For the second event in a row, we've got Jordan Spieth in the mix. Obviously, that's great on Jordan Spieth playing great golf. If he weren't playing great golf, it'd be a little bit different story, perhaps. But you still would have had wins by Dustin Johnson and by Justin Thomas. The two of the three guys have won events that are still in the potential conversation for player of the year. Obviously, at this point, Thomas winning by three at TPC Boston does as much as he can at this point in the playoffs to have locked up player of the year honors. I think that the only way right now someone other than Justin Thomas wins player of the year is in a scenario where either Dustin Johnson or Jordan Spieth win out, right? They both got to win the BMW Championship next week, top 70 players, and the Tour Championship, which would imply then they would win the FedEx Cup. And in the case of Dustin Johnson, he would probably have to do it by like a combined 15 shots. Like, he'd have to murder everybody, and it wouldn't be close to make up for the fact that he didn't win a major this year. And if you're Jordan Spieth, if you just win the other two, you pretty much have the same profile as Justin Thomas for the year in terms of victories, in terms of what those victories are, and then you get another FedEx Cup title on top of it, and all of a sudden maybe he is the player of the year. But I think that's really the only situation where that happens. I don't think if Jordan Spieth doesn't win the BMW but somehow wins either the Tour Championship or wins the FedEx Cup or both in Eastlake, I don't think that necessarily changes the minds of the players who vote on this award. I mean, it's a peer-voted award. That's why it's special. That's why it means something. It's different than the PGA of America's point-based Player of the Year award. Hey, this is your peer saying, you were the best guy this year. Kudos to you. And all the things that come with it, especially for Justin Thomas, who is in a contract year, so to speak, with Titleist. So he can go seek out potential large money in terms of that equipment sponsorship. I don't know what his other deals are like with City or Polo or companies like that. So he might be in a different position with those particular deals. But going into the 17, basically into calendar 18 season, he has a potential to cash in on some deals. Now, the marketplace is probably a little bit different than we would have expected maybe a few years ago. Obviously, Nike getting out of the equipment space in 2016 changes things a little bit. And I think that more companies are also seeing not less value, but different value, maybe less value, in tour sponsorships. I mean, ultimately, golf is very different at the professional level and even more different at a PGA Tour level than what you and I play week to week. It just is. I mean, those guys hit the ball 310, 320, 340, 350, wedge into most holes. They demolish 500-yard par fours. A 600-yard par five really isn't that big of a deal for them. In fact, the data shows they score better the longer the holes get past 600 yards, which is kind of frightening. And it's just different. And so the level of influence that a Justin Thomas or Jordan Spieth or Dustin Johnson could have on the average player who totally knows they are not swinging the same stuff, at least in terms of all the components compared to those guys who are the best in the world, and that they're never going to hit a 330. They're never going to hit a 350. So they need to be looking for different equipment. And maybe they keep it in the same family. Maybe you like the look of TaylorMade stuff, or you like the look of Ping stuff or Titleist stuff. You go down the line because you've seen your favorite players on tour swing it. But that's really the gateway to a purchase, as opposed to having the kind of influence that these companies probably want for the money that they're spending, you know, the seven and maybe eight-figure sums that they're spending per year for these guys to play their stuff and win doing it. And to a certain extent, I'm sure there's value in that, but I don't know the kind of $10 million a year Nike deal. Maybe it's there. Maybe it's there for Justin Thomas, that kind of level of deal. Maybe it's not with Nike. Polo's a great sponsor. They're not going to pay $10 million, but good deals are to be had, but maybe not to that kind of exorbitant level. I think we may have seen the peak of that market, at least for now. So it'll be interesting to see what Thomas does in the offseason, whether he makes any changes, whether he sticks with what he's doing. No idea where that is. I don't know Justin Thomas well enough to tell you that. You should go talk to Solly at No Laying Up. He can probably tell you what Justin Thomas is going to do for his equipment and stuff next year. But nonetheless, we've had two really good playoff events. And if you look back at the winners of the playoff events, and really the last 10 of them, and I don't have a list in front of me, but I can kind of work my way through them, and you think about the guys who have won them, you think about Dustin Johnson, you think about Rory McIlroy, you think about Jordan Spieth and Jason Day and Justin Thomas, and just go down the line of guys who have played great in the playoffs in 15 and 16 and now in 17. The playoffs have delivered, and we wrote a piece on golfnewsnet.com. Hey, this is how we would improve the FedEx Cup volume 30. Like, this is the way we would do it to get to match play, which is really what everyone wants, I think. But television doesn't really want it because of the variable that match play is. It can be two nobodies. It could be David Goliath. It could be not competitive, even between two great players. It can kind of be tough to broadcast, particularly if you had one match for $10 million. It would just be not ideal for television. This is why we're never going to get it. But, as I said in the piece, the FedEx Cup is good. I said not bad, but it's good. It is delivering great end-of-season golf for 2.5 years running now without a bad event, really. And that's not necessarily because of the point system. It's because these guys are really good, and we've got a crop of players now, a definitive top 7 or 8 players in the world, all of them except Dustin Johnson under 30, and they're playing incredible multiple win season kind of golf. Rory McIlroy's off that pace, but he's in that top 7 players in the world. Ricky Fowler didn't win multiple times this year, but is in that kind of caliber. John Rahm only won once this year so far, but still as a rookie is ranked 5th in the official World Golf Ranking and the FedEx Cup system. Those guys will win multiple times and have the ability to win multiple times every season for at least another 10 years. I mean, you can keep going down the line. And then in Spieth, Thomas, Matsuyama, and Dustin Johnson, got guys who are winning 3, 4, 5 times a year and making it look pretty routine. I mean, you look at the PGA Tour schedule, I think there are, what, 47 events overall, you know, in the calendar year on the PGA Tour, and then obviously by season because the way it stretches out. But the way you look at it, you go, that's incredible. You can pitch 20 of those events, basically, to seven guys, and you go, okay, well, the rest of you get 27 of them. Good luck. And three or four of those are opposite field events, and then the others are kind of guys like Kevin Kisner and Billy Horschel and Brian Harman, great, great players, but they're not on the level of this apparent top five, six, seven, whatever. And it's not the big five, six, or seven. It's just a fluid young group of guys that could all pass each other at any time, but they're great, great players, and they're winning at an incredible clip. And we really haven't seen anything like this in recent memory. Obviously, we had 20 years of Tiger Woods pitching five, six, seven wins a year, up to nine wins a year, and going, all right, well, he's great, but what's everyone else going to do? And a lot of parity in between after you got past guys like Vijay or Ernie or Phil Mickelson, guys that were good for two or three wins a year, maybe most years, especially the pinnacle of their powers. Vijay obviously had an incredible 04 and played great in 05 and really had this run where he was like, all right, I'm the greatest over 40 player ever. Now he's doing tremendous things in his almost mid-50s, still being competitive on the PGA Tour, doing well in PGA Tour champions. But even before that, you looked at a good season on the PGA Tour pre-Tiger. Think about years with Nick Price and Greg Norman, where he had some handful win seasons. But you look at those years, you go, two, three, four wins was incredible. Three wins in a major was like, all right, you're the player of the year. Let's wrap up the voting. It's over. And now we have guys, all right, you got to get to five wins to have a chance. That's awesome. I hope that this keeps up. I would love to see the kind of dominating parity, if that makes sense, where you have this clear upper tier that we've established, that these guys are all capable of multiple wins every year. They may not do it, but they're capable of it, and that maybe two or three or four of them each year are going to do it. They're going to win three or more times in a year and make a really interesting race, not only going into the FedEx Cup playoffs, but set themselves so far apart that maybe for two or three more years, it's just, all right, the FedEx Cup is going to go to one of these five guys for each of the next two or three or four years when they're playing some of their best golf. I think that would be great for the PGA Tour. I think that would be great for developing golf fans in general. I know from a demographic standpoint, the obvious talking point is, all right, all these guys are white dudes. They don't stand out from the average golfing guy. It's just true. But they all have personalities. They all approach the game slightly differently. They all have slightly nuanced strengths and weaknesses, even though all of them are powerful in their own way. All of them have great short games in their own ways, except McIlroy's a little streakier than the others. But you kind of go down the line of what all of these guys can do and who they are and how they're different. And I think that that's awesome. I think that's exactly what we need for this generation. And I'm not saying that to grow the game. I have no idea whether it grows the game. And I really do not necessarily think that professional golfers inherently grow the game. I think the Tiger effect was a myth. It actually was a myth, if you look at the data. And you can search that on golfnewsnet.com if you ever want to read a 2,500-word piece about why Tiger had no influence on golf. But these guys do influence young fans. And you have scores of kids wearing Puma gear at PGA Tour events because they're fans of Ricky. Same thing with Nike and Under Armour for McIlroy and Spieth. You've got guys who probably a little bit older who wear Adidas because they just love Dustin Johnson or Sergio for that matter, and just want to ball out in the same way that he does. They don't have the Tiger Cat swagger, but Jungle Cat swagger, but they wear Adidas. So I think that there is a fan base developing for golf, and it flies in the face of the negative data that you get about ratings and how it compares. You know, the PGA Championship ratings were not good. They were low. I think the lowest in 10 years, going back to 08 when it was Harrington versus Garcia at Oakland Hills. It was that level of low. But then you go, wait, every other sport's got sagging ratings, basically, except the NBA Finals and the Super Bowl. And the NBA Finals are because they have the two best super teams in a rivalry we probably won't see again for another 20 years. So there's a reason people are tuning in for those amazing games. NFL's the NFL, even though that week-to-week viewership kind of sagged a little bit last year. You still had a great turnout for the Super Bowl. And then every other sport's kind of like, you know, the World Series is down. The NHL's up and down, depending on the caliber of the finals, but it kind of is what it is. Golf is resetting itself. And golf has reset itself in a good way because you've got a younger set of fans who are coming in. And I'm not saying we want to push the older fans out, but those younger fans have come in and they consume golf in a different way. They watch PGA Tour live on their phone or on Twitter. They interact with golf through social media, and they don't necessarily watch the rounds live. They might DVR it, or they might watch the recap that the PGA Tour produces. You can watch a round in 30 minutes. It's just, it's a different way the PGA Tour looks at what's being successful. And while the ratings are basically flat on television, they have exploded elsewhere. And I think that's something important to keep in mind. And that's true across sport. We look at television ratings and go, oh, people are stopping watching sports. No, they're just consuming it differently. And you're consuming it right now at an awesome time and maybe a second golden age of the PGA Tour where you've got, again, a crop of 7-8 guys that are relatively young, with DJ being the oldest at 33, and I can't believe he's 33, and still playing golf like a 25-year-old. And this is going to be the way it's going to be for a while. And we've still got Patrick Cantlay, who hasn't missed a cut this year. We've still got guys coming out of college like Mav McNealy, who's going to be awesome. You can kind of go down the line. Curtis Luck turned in a great post-US amateur turning pro performance. Keep going down the list of young guys who are someday going to potentially be in that upper echelon that could expand. And we're in for a great run. Great run. It's going to be fascinating to watch. All right, so let's bring in Maurice Allen. So we talked with Maurice, who, again, is the number one long driver in the world, according to the World Long Drive Association, or Long Drivers of America, depending on how you remember them before Golf Channel purchased it all. And unfortunately, he got knocked out before we did this interview earlier in the afternoon on Wednesday the 6th. But I wanted to have him on anyway, and he was graciously game to do it, because I wanted to talk about his rise to number one in the world, what it's like to be a long driver as a profession, and kind of get people who are maybe curious about long drive some information about how you should watch the sport. And interestingly enough, it relies a lot on TrackMan, as you might imagine, but it requires a little bit different way of thinking, slightly different, almost kind of the way that the professional golfer thinks, but with some tweaks to it. And we get into all kinds of other interesting facets of what it's like to be Maurice Allen, what it's like to be a long driver. So enjoy the conversation. Maurice, thanks for being with us on the show. You've had an incredible year. You've become number one in the world. Can you talk us through the kind of year that you've had and what it means to you personally to become the number one ranked long driver in the world?
Definitely. The last 3 years for me have been, it's very humbling. Every year the last 3 years has actually been a career year. So I'm not certain how long I can keep that type of a pace up. That's not something that's the norm. Went from winning three events in 2015, winning my first major event, and then becoming the European Tour champion, ranked number one in Europe. And then I turned around in 2016 and had four wins, came back to back on the European Tour championship, as well as staying number one. So I held that spot for 2 years. And then to come this year and go and win three events in the States, win my first event in the States, and to move up to the number one spot in the world ranking, that is absolutely three career years back to back. Someone told me yesterday that, you know, that's a Hall of Fame career, which is a whole nother type of ball game that kind of wigs me out just a tad bit. But it's been more of an opportunity as well as a responsibility. Long drive is a sport that's on the rise right now, and to have the honor to be one of the key faces in the sport, it's definitely a responsibility to help grow the sport, help make it where players are able to make a living doing this. A lot of people have stories, as you hear with tour players and other things like that, of people living outside their cars and people not having enough enough money to pay the bills and making it from just stop to stop to stop, and almost a situation where you're robbing Peter to pay Paul. And long drive is a sport where I think people should be able to, especially the top 25 guys in the world, to be able to make a good living, even a six-figure salary. I don't think that there's anything wrong with that. So to try to be an ambassador to help grow the sport to that level is definitely something that I've been trying to do.
For people that maybe are casual fans that watch the World Long Drive Championship once a year, or even now with the more televised events here in the U.S. on Golf Channel, they may not have a sense of how much you guys travel, how often you're on the road, and how much globetrotting you do to do what you do for a living. Can you give an idea of how many miles you travel every year and how many days you are physically doing your job as a long driver?
It's weird. So as a long driver, you do a combination of events, tour events, charity scrambles, exhibitions and outings. So for me, I'm probably traveling anywhere from 32 to 42 weeks a year. My house in Atlanta is literally an overused storage locker. That's it, because I'm never there. I think some months I'm there 4 days a week at best. So it's definitely an issue of making sure that it's so funny. You have to try to keep your body in shape. You have to keep your mind sharp. You know, your fitness is another issue. Trying to keep your meals together, because obviously you're living out of a car or on the road. So you're traveling as far as making sure that you're getting healthy meals that will allow your body to replenish itself based on the amount of work that you're giving it. It's tough. It's definitely a tough life, that's for sure.
What are the things that you do or try to do to give yourself a sense of normal / home for as often as you're away? Or is that just a notion you've kind of gotten rid of over time?
Yeah, I don't believe that there's a sense of normalcy. I don't believe that there's a sense of home. For me, I'm really a homebody, so I just kind of hang out. I do my own thing. I don't really get into it too much as far as going out and partying and living that. But definitely when I have the opportunity to go home and to be around my family, I definitely do that. I love hanging out with my parents and things of that nature. But what you do is you find that when you travel as much as we do, you'll find little homes away from home, and little spots where you may like to eat, and it kind of gives you a sense of normalcy and things of that nature.
As the volume of opportunities to play for better money has increased, how have you found the competition has changed, either gotten deeper or stronger at the top, because there are more opportunities to actually make a decent check in long drive?
I don't think it has anything to do with the check. I think it has everything to do with the Golf Channel. The Golf Channel is running the sport in a way where it is absolutely perfect, and it's going to continue to grow, and people have the opportunity to get on TV. And for a lot of people, especially with the millennials, you know, likes and things of that nature are absolutely everything, and they are – that's what people are going for, the opportunity to get on TV and to get the likes and people to hit the like button and to get more followers on Instagram and all that stuff. That's what it's, you know, and then the money's somewhat secondary, but when you look at your Instagram or you look at any of your social media, it's amazing how you have people who are quote-unquote public figures and get paid for advertising on their social media sites. So, you know, the young kids now are very, very entrepreneurial, and they find ways to make the cash, and this would be something that could give them a platform that would allow them to do so.
How has the attention that's come your way changed, not only by virtue of getting to be number one in the world, but because of that additional exposure Golf Channel's offered?
You know, it doesn't change me at all. I've always been somebody who people have been drawn to in this sport for one reason or another. Even back when I first started, I'm not exactly sure what it is that makes me special, but it's always been something there. And I've always had the mindset of trying to make it better for others. That's just the type of person that I am. It's never been something about self. It's always been about trying to make things better for my fellow competitors. And I think by doing that, I'll also make things better for myself as well. But it's just not a one-shot deal.
And have you had more fan attention because of having more time on television with Golf Channel, having the sport in front of more people who might not have seen it before?
Yeah, I've had that happen. I mean, you go in the airport and people want to take a picture with you, or you go to, especially around the golf courses, that's something that happens. And, I mean, to me, it's a humbling experience. I mean, being around professional athletes my entire life, that has been something that I've seen, and I've looked at how they deal with it, and it's a part of the job. I mean, even when you go out there and you lose an event, you still have to give an interview. You still have to make sure that you're that face for the sport. You're always putting something positive out there, because truth be told to you, you're never going to win every event, but you still have the opportunity to grow the sport or to build a fan. And that's what you're obligated to do as in being a public figure.
And if some of the guys who maybe are relatively new to the sport, have they approached you about any aspects of counsel and advice on how to actually be successful at this profession?
No, the Golf Channel does an amazing job at having a summit every year where they help give the athletes the opportunity to learn about social media platforms, following and going after sponsors, how to determine how to obtain agents and who is a good agent and a publicist and things of that nature. So those things have been done and put forth by the Golf Channel. And there are some people who will go in and ask other competitors based upon their personal experiences, what is good, how do they move forward, and things of that nature. And I've had some people ask me that, but the Golf Channel really has a great system set up for the hitters to give them somewhat of the training wheels on how to make things happen. And then from there, they're able to kind of put their own twist to it.
Kind of shifting gears to the format of the World Long Drive Championship, at least the final round, the rounds that are on TV have changed a little bit this year. You know, over the last couple of years, it was, 3-minute sessions, and the longest ball that you hit was kind of the one that counted, and that went against the guy you were facing. Now it's more 8-ball sets, which is something that seems more commonplace in the events that you guys hold. Did you like that decision? What did you think about it? And do you think it helps in the long haul identify the right guy that week?
You know, I'm a person who likes to really, neither one of them, I don't care either way. I think that when someone sets a list of rules and regulations for you to compete and abide by, you go out there and you compete with them. I mean, if you have a problem with it, then you stay home. I mean, but for me, I just adapt. It's, you know, when people are giving you the opportunity to showcase your talent and your ability, you need to be grateful for that, and that's something that I am. And I think too many times in society, we always compare and contrast and almost get to a point where we're nitpicky on things rather than just saying, hey, this is something that's amazing. This is something that's awesome. It gives me a platform and an ability that I've never had before. So I'm going to make the most out of this situation and find a way to adapt to it just like everybody else would.
So what's the vibe like at Worlds compared to either a regular World Long Drive or Long Drivers of America event versus a European Tour event versus, you know, something maybe on a lesser scale? How is the vibe different for you? How is the vibe different for your fellow competitors?
For me, Worlds is probably the toughest competition ever, just because for me the adrenaline's up. I don't really sleep for almost a week, which I've never really had an amazing run at Worlds. Hopefully that'll change maybe next season, and I'll find a way to cope and to deal with the lack of sleep or the adrenaline that's going through my body. But I think as time goes on, Worlds will not have so much of a huge effect as it does now, because there will be more competitions. Though the Golf Channel will come up with a system that has a set of majors and what the majors are, and they'll just be a major, and then the other tournaments, there'll be more of those, and there'll be more televised events, and it's something that will just continue to grow from that stance, and it won't just be something that's way athletes so heavily as it is today.
It sounds like UC or Golf Channel has laid out its vision for a long-term future for long drives of the sport on TV and growing in the United States. Can you kind of offer a sense of either what your vision of that is or what Golf Channel has said, hey, this is what we're going to do 3-5 years from now?
Golf Channel I believe that they have a vision of growing the sport worldwide, not just here in the States. And it's going to be a household thing. And it's like anything else. When you're growing a brand, you have to be extremely careful on how you do it and to make sure that that product is the same everywhere it goes, or at least it mimics the same product over and over, no matter where you go. And I think that in upcoming years, as this thing gets bigger and as more players come out, it gets more publicity and it crosses barriers as it has this season over to other media outlets, mainstream media outlets, not just the Golf Channels, but the ESPNs and everybody else, with that Sky Sports and things of that nature, I think that it will grow into something absolutely amazing where you have people just lining up to do this thing, and then you may end up with a developmental league somewhat like the web.com, and then you'll have your pro league like you see with the PGA Tour, which would be your, WLDA, and it would be awesome.
Do you think that there could be a day, maybe it's not 4 years from now or 8 years from now, maybe it's 12 years from now, but that long drive could be an Olympic sport and that would be a huge benefit to the sport?
You know, that's been a topic of conversation on so many different levels, and it would be interesting to see where it goes. I'm not going to say no. I'm not going to say yes. I'm going to say I don't know.
There's kind of been this movement also in long drive towards paralong drive, and we've seen a little bit of growth of that. Obviously, those para sports are their own animal, and they have their own set of requirements to get into the Paralympic Games and things like that. But has there been much interaction between paralong drive and long drive as a sport?
Yeah, there are quite a few guys, Chris Osborne and Dean Jarvis, and there's quite a few other para competitors that reach out to other long drivers. We talk to each other about equipment and swings and motions and things of that nature. So there is definitely a bond between the two. And I think when you start bringing up the paralong drive, that is one of the major focal points that will be in effect when you're talking about long drive going into the Olympics. That will be one of the major conversations that is had, and the para long drive will definitely be one of the leading points into that.
You mentioned a second ago there's kind of some sharing of kind of swing thought and technique and ideas. Golf, proper golf, so to speak, always has kind of this conversation about where the swing's going, what people should be doing, and there's kind of been this change of how to generate power using your feet and stuff like that. But long drive's been ahead of the curve in that regard. Do you think long drive somewhat can influence the power game that's developed in professional golf?
I'm not certain of that. I think that there are two different animals with two different thought processes, and I think that they're both a interesting amount of poetry that should be viewed in two separate arenas, but still admired for their beauty.
I think I've asked this before of a couple of other long drivers we had on the podcast, but do you view long drive more as an art than a science, or more as a science than an art?
I think it's both. To be in the sport of long drive, you are definitely in a situation where you become extremely scientific to figure out the physics behind the launch and the spin and the ball speeds and the lateral spin and things of that nature and positive attack angles versus, how are you getting into the ball, body positions, biomechanics. And the art of it is what you do to make those numbers happen. And that's why you can have so many different swings that look, a million miles apart, but could get somewhere in the same realm of numbers. And that's the beauty of it. So maybe if you said that it's a science and an art, maybe it's a science and a swag would be a better way of putting it. Because everybody has their own swag that they put on to the golf swing. And compared to the PGA Tour, there are many different swings on the PGA Tour, but there are quite a few that mimic each other. But in the long drive scene, that's very, very, very rare that you see two swings that mimic or that are alike.
And why do you think that is? Do you think it's because people come from such different backgrounds of athletics and the ways that they get into long drive?
The athletic backgrounds are completely different, so people are different. Their experiences are different. Their strengths and their weaknesses are different. Their views are different, and that allows for something that is absolutely beautiful to take place.
And how has equipment evolved? Because kind of initially, maybe 10 years ago, I mean, it was a little bit of a different game than now where you have Crank doing great things, you've got Callaway doing great things, and you're pushing the limits of what equipment can do to perform for you guys all the time. Has that meant a change at all in how you guys approach the sport with different materials at your disposal?
You know, when you look at companies like Crank or Callaway or Brute, and the other manufacturers that are out there, they are definitely pushing the limits. That's where the science, another part of the science part is coming into it. You look at the shaft side, that's yet another part of the science. The ball with Volvic and the things that they've done. I mean, science is definitely a big key part on the manufacturer side and as well as the club building side. So everybody's pushing the limits, and that's why I said it's definitely a part of the client side, because everybody's trying to find that extra mile an hour or 2 miles an hour or that 500, you know, reduction in spin and things of that nature. So there's definitely a huge science behind everything in this sport.
Kind of last question, and that is from a viewer's perspective, as you know, we'll have this up kind of post world, getting a sense of whoever winds up winning from the final eight that are going to be on the air on Wednesday night. When people are watching long drive moving forward, can you give them a sense of kind of the smart way to watch long drive instead of just looking at a total yardage number? What are the kind of pieces of information they should be looking at on TV to be better informed of what's going on?
When you look at it on TV, there are three major numbers that pop up. There's a swing speed, there's a ball speed, and there's an apex. When you look at the swing speed, that only tells you the potential of what their ball speed could be if they had a 1.5 or 1.51, 1.52 smash factor. Their ball speed will tell you exactly how efficient they were out of that swing. And the apex will pretty much tell you their launch. And you look at the shot shape, if it's moving from right to left, or if it's moving from left to right, or if it's just going dead straight. And that'll give you a very good understanding. Now, what you may find is you have a guy who moves the ball at 217 miles an hour, but his ball was actually shorter than a guy whose ball speed was 211 miles an hour. And that's where the one factor that they don't throw up there, which is spin. And you can get a ball that will be spinny and it'll come back shorter, even though it was swung harder and hit harder. But I think the more that it's on TV and the more we get the commentary going, we'll make sure that people understand those things and they'll know exactly what to look for. And they'll really be able to enjoy the sheer beauty behind the sport.
Well, I hope that's the case, and I hope they learned something by listening to you talking to me. I appreciate you coming on and educating us a little bit and getting us to help to know long drive a little bit more. Hopefully we can keep the conversation going.
All right. Well, thank you so much, and I appreciate the opportunity, and I hope to be talking to you guys again soon.
Thanks again to Maurice Allen for being on with us. Great chill guy to talk to. We had a lot of fun. I could have peppered him with questions for another 25 minutes, but I felt like I didn't want to just hit him with a litany of questions about being a long driver, because he probably would have thought I was going to head over and take up a qualifier myself. But I love watching long drive. I really get a kick out of seeing the power that these guys possess. And as Maurice alluded to, the unique swings that each guy has. As golf has become more professional from a younger age, at AJGA level with instruction and tournament quality, all that stuff, there is a uniqueness to every swing. Of course, every swing is a snowflake, but they look more and more alike, and the game is becoming more homogenous as it becomes more of a power sport. And interestingly enough, in a power sport that is long drive, things are getting a little bit more unique. They're getting a little bit, not more unique, they're getting a little bit more differentiated. Not every swing is the same. Not everybody approaches the sport the same way. Everyone comes from a different background, how they got into the sport, why they're in the sport, what they're doing with the sport, how they approach their craft. And I think that offers an alternative to what people probably just think is raw power and muscle. Yeah, that's part of it. Of course, it's part of it. But there is, as Maurice alluded to, a science part. There's an art part, and that comes together in a spectacle that's really cool to watch on TV. And I'm really glad Golf Channel made the investment. I'm glad that they're doing what they're doing to promote the sport, not only in the open division with men, but also in the putting the women's division on television, putting decent prize money behind it, and giving a platform for players like Troy Mullins to go out there and do their thing and show that the average looking person can hit a 400-yard drive and you don't have to be muscles on top of muscles. It's pretty incredible stuff to watch. Hopefully, by the time that you listen to this, you either had a chance to catch some of the World Long Drive Championship, or you can watch it on a replay, of course, on Golf Channel. Hopefully, you get to take it in, because it's, like I said, one of my favorite things to watch. It's just, I don't know, it's engrossing to me, so I enjoy it. All right, next time on the show, we will have a BMW Championship winner. We will have our top 30 for the Tour Championship and the top 30 guys who could win the FedEx Cup and $10 million. We will be closer to having our matches ready to rock and roll the President's Cup. So we've still got a lot of great golf to go through as we get into the fall, officially speaking, as we get to the end of the PGA Tour season. And we'll keep doing our podcast basically through December, end of December, like we do every year. And we got plenty to talk about with the European Tour coming to a close. We've got a final major for golf with the Evian Championship over in France on the LPGA. Still so much to talk about. So hit us up on Twitter at Ryan Ballingy or at Golf News Net. If you have a chance, follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/golfnewsnet. And if you listen to us on iTunes, please give us a 5-star review in your podcast or iTunes app. We would really appreciate it. It helps us reach more people. So until next time, I'm Ryan Ballingy saying thank you for listening, and we'll catch you next time on the 19th Hole Golf Show.